If I am flying from London to New York, I am moving westwards, even before leaving the British coast. The science fiction in which we have just been indulging has, then, two important morals. The first is that if the game of order versus chance is to continue as a game, order must not win. As prediction and control increase, so, in proportion, the game ceases to be worth the candle. We look for a new game with an uncertain result. In other words, we have to hide again, perhaps in a new way, and then seek in new ways, since the two together make up the dance and the wonder of existence. Contrarywise, chance must not win, and probably cannot, because the order-slash-chance polarity appears to be of the same kind as the on-slash-off and up-slash-down. Some astronomers believe that our universe began with an explosion that hurled all the galaxies into space, where, through negative entropy, it will dissolve forever into featureless radiation. I cannot think this way. It is, I suppose, my basic metaphysical axiom, my leap of faith, that what happened once can always happen again. Not so much that there must be time before the first explosion and time after the final dissolution, but that time, like space, curves back on itself. This assumption is strengthened by the second moral of these fantasies, which is the more startling. Here applies the French proverb, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. The more it changes, the more it's the same thing. Change is in some sense an illusion, for we are always at the point where any future can take us. If the human race develops an electronic nervous system outside the bodies of individual people, thus giving us all one mind and one global body, this is almost precisely what has happened in the organization of cells which compose our own bodies. We have already done it. Furthermore, our bodily cells and their smallest components appear and disappear much as light waves vibrate and as people go from birth to death. A human body is like a whirlpool. There seems to be a constant form, called the whirlpool, but it functions for the very reason that no water stays in it. The very molecules and atoms of the water are also whirlpools, patterns of motion containing no constant and irreducible stuff. Every person is the form taken by a stream, a marvelous torrent of milk, water, bread, beefsteak, fruit, vegetables, air, light, radiation, all of which are streams in their own turn. So, with our institutions, there is a constant called the University of California, in which nothing stays put. Students, faculty, administrators, and even buildings come and go, leaving the university itself only as a continuing process, a pattern of behavior. As to powers of prediction and control, the individual organism has already accomplished these in a measure which must have astounded the neurons when they first learned the trick. And if we reproduce ourselves in terms of mechanical, plastic, and electronic patterns, this is not really new. Any evolving species must look with misgivings on those of its members who first show signs of change, and will surely regard them as dangerous or crazy. Moreover, this new and unexpected type of reproduction is surely no more weird than many of the great variety of methods already found in the biological world. The startling transformation of caterpillar into butterfly, or the arrangement between bees and flowers, or the unpleasant but marvelously complex system of the Anopheles mosquito. If all this ends with the human race leaving no more trace of itself in the universe than a system of electronic patterns, why should that trouble us? For that is exactly what we are now. Flesh or plastic, intelligence or mechanism, nerve or wire, biology or physics, it all seems to come down to this fabulous electronic dance, which, at the macroscopic level, presents itself to itself as the whole gamut of forms and substances. But the underlying problem of cybernetics, which makes it an endless success/failure, is to control the process of control itself. Power is not necessarily wisdom. I may have virtual omnipotence in the government of my body and my physical environment, but how am I to control myself so as to avoid folly and error in its use? Geneticists and neurologists may come to the point of being able to produce any type of human character to order. But how will they be able to know what types of character will be needed? The situation of a pioneer culture calls for tough and aggressive individualists, whereas urban industrial culture requires sociable and cooperative team workers. As social change increases in speed, how are geneticists to foresee the adaptations of taste, temperament, and motivation that will be necessary 20 or 30 years ahead? Furthermore, every act of interference with the course of nature changes it in unpredictable ways. A human organism which has absorbed antibiotics is not quite the same kind of organism that it was before, because the behavior of its microorganisms has been significantly altered. The more one interferes, the more one must analyze an ever-growing volume of detailed information about the results of interference on a world whose infinite details are inextricably interwoven. Already this information, even in the most highly specialized sciences, is so vast that no individual has time to read it, let alone absorb it. In solving problems, technology creates new problems, and we seem, as in Through the Looking Glass, to have to keep running faster and faster to stay where we are. The question is, then, whether technical progress actually gets anywhere in the sense of increasing the delight and happiness of life. There is certainly a sense of exhilaration or relief at the moment of change, at the first few uses of telephone, radio, television, jet aircraft, miracle drug, or calculating machine. But all too soon, these new contrivances are taken for granted, and we find ourselves oppressed with the new predicaments which they bring with them. A successful college president once complained to me, "I'm so busy that I'm going to have to get a helicopter." "Well," I answered, "you'll be ahead so long as you're the only president who has one. But don't get it. Everyone will expect more out of you." Technical progress is certainly impressive from the short-run standpoint of the individual. Speaking as an old man in the 1960s, Sir Cedric Hardwicke said that his only regret was that he could not have lived in the Victorian age, with penicillin. "I am still grateful that I do not have to submit to the doctoring and dentistry of my childhood, yet I realize that advances in one field are interlocked with advances in all others. I could not have penicillin or modern anesthesia without aviation, electronics, mass communication, superhighways, and industrial agriculture, not to mention the atomic bomb and biological warfare." Taking, therefore, a longer and wider view of things, the entire project of conquering nature appears more and more of a mirage, an increase in the pace of living without fundamental change of position, just as the Red Queen suggested. But technical progress becomes a way of stalling faster and faster because of the basic illusion that man and nature, the organism and the environment, the controller and the controlled, are quite different things. We might conquer nature if we could first, or at the same time, conquer our own nature, though we do not see that human nature and outside nature are all of a piece. In the same way, we do not see that I, as the knower and controller, am the same fellow as myself, as something to be known and controlled. The self-conscious feedback mechanism of the cortex allows us the hallucination that we are two souls in one body, a rational soul and an animal soul, a rider and a horse, a good guy with better instincts and finer feelings, and a rascal with rapacious lusts and unruly passions. Hence the marvelously involved hypocrisies of guilt and penitence, and the frightful cruelties of punishment, warfare, and even self-torment in the name of taking the side of the good soul against the evil. The more it sides with itself, the more the good soul reveals its inseparable shadow, and the more it disowns its shadow, the more it becomes it. Thus, for thousands of years, human history has been a magnificently futile conflict, a wonderfully staged panorama of triumphs and tragedies based on the resolute taboo against admitting that black goes with white. Nothing, perhaps, ever got nowhere with so much fascinating ado. As when Tweedledum and Tweedledee agreed to have a battle, the essential trick of the game of black and white is the most tacit conspiracy for the partners to conceal their unity and to look as different as possible. It is like a stage fight so well acted that the audience is ready to believe it a real fight. Hidden behind their explicit differences is the implicit unity of what Vedanta calls the self, the one without a second, the what there is and the all that there is, which conceals itself in the form of you. If, then, there is this basic unity between self and other, individual and universe, how have our minds become so narrow that we don't know it? 3. How to be a genuine fake. The cat has already been let out of the bag. The inside information is that yourself as just little me, who came into this world and lives temporarily in a bag of skin, is a hoax and a fake. The fact is that because no one thing or feature of this universe is separable from the whole, the only real you or self is the whole. The rest of this book will attempt to make this so clear that you will not only understand the words, but feel the fact. The first step is to understand, as vividly as possible, how the hoax begins. We must first look at the form and behavior of the hoax itself. I have long been interested in trying to find out how people experience, or sense, their own existence. For what specific sensations do they use the word I? Few people seem to use the word for their whole physical organism. I have a body is more common than I am a body. We speak of my legs, as we speak of my clothes, and I seems to remain intact, even if the legs are amputated. We say, I speak, I walk, I think, and even I breathe. But we do not say, I shape my bones, I grow my nails, and I circulate my blood. We seem to use I for something in the body, but not really of the body. For much of what goes on in the body seems to happen to I in the same way as external events. I is used as the center of voluntary behavior and conscious attention, but not consistently. Breathing is only partially voluntary, and we say, I was sick, or I dreamed, or I fell asleep, as if the verbs were not passive, but active. Nevertheless, I usually refers to a center in the body, but different peoples feel it in different places. For some cultures, it is in the region of the solar plexus. The Chinese Xin, the heart, mind, or soul, is found in the center of the chest. But most Westerners locate the ego in the head, from which center the rest of us dangles. The ego is somewhere behind the eyes and between the ears. It is as if there sat beneath the dome of the skull a controlling officer who wears earphones wired to the ears and watches a television screen wired to the eyes. Before him stands a great panel of dials and switches connected with all other parts of the body that yield conscious information or respond to the officer's will. This controlling officer sees sights, hears sounds, feels feelings, and has experiences. These are common but redundant ways of talking, for seeing a sight is just seeing, hearing a sound is just hearing, feeling a feeling is just feeling, and having an experience is just experiencing. But that these redundant phrases are so commonly used shows that most people think of themselves as separate from their thoughts and experiences. All this can get marvelously complicated when we begin to wonder whether our officer has another officer inside his head, and so ad infinitum. There was a young man who said, though it seems that I know, what I would like to see is the I that knows me, when I know that I know that I know. One of the most important items in our officer's equipment is his recording and filing system, the memory, which he constantly consults so as to know how to interpret and respond to his sensory input. Without this equipment, he could have no sensation of constancy, of being the same officer as he was seconds ago. Although memory records are much more fluid and elusive than photographic film or magnetic tape, the accumulation of memories is an essential part of the ego sensation. It gives the impression of oneself, the officer, as something that remains while life goes by, as if the conscious self were a stable mirror reflecting a passing procession. This further exaggerates the feeling of separateness, of oneself changing at a pace so much slower than outside events and inside thoughts, that you seem to stand aside from them as an independent observer. But memories persist as the whirlpool persists. Conscious attention seems to scan them as computers scan their ever-cycling tapes or other storage mechanisms. Memory is an enduring pattern of motion, like the whirlpool, rather than an enduring substance, like a mirror, a wax tablet, or a sheet of paper. If memories are stored in neurons, there is no standing aside from the stream of events, for neurons flow along in the same stream as events outside the skull. After all, your neurons are part of my external world, and mine of yours. All our insides are outside, there in the physical world. But conversely, the outside world has no color, shape, weight, heat, or motion without inside brains. It has these qualities only in relation to brains, which are, in turn, members of itself. Wherever people may feel that the ego is located, and however much or little of the physical body is identified with it, almost all agree that I am not anything outside my skin. As Shakespeare's King John says to Hubert, "Within this wall of flesh there is a soul, counts thee her creditor." The skin is always considered as a wall, barrier, or boundary which definitively separates oneself from the world, despite the fact that it is covered with pores breathing air and with nerve ends relaying information. The skin informs us just as much as it outforms. It is as much a bridge as a barrier. Nevertheless, it is our firm conviction that beyond this wall of flesh lies an alien world only slightly concerned with us, so that much energy is required to command or attract its attention or to change its behavior. It was there before we were born, and it will continue after we die. We live in it temporarily as rather unimportant fragments, disconnected and alone. This whole illusion has its history and ways of thinking in the images, models, myths, and language systems which we have used for thousands of years to make sense of the world. These have had an effect on our perceptions which seem to be strictly hypnotic. It is largely by talking that a hypnotist produces illusions and strange behavioral changes in his subjects. Talking, coupled with relaxed fixation of the subject's conscious attention. The stage magician, too, performs most of his illusions by patter and misdirection of attention. Hypnotic illusions can be vividly sensuous and real to the subject, even after he has come out of the so-called hypnotic trance. It is then as if the human race had hypnotized or talked itself into the hoax of egocentricity. There is no one to blame but ourselves. We are not victims of a conspiracy arranged by an external god or some secret society of manipulators. If there is any biological foundation for the hoax, it lies only in the brain's capacity for narrowed, attentive consciousness, hand in hand with its power of recognition, of knowing about knowing and thinking about thinking with the use of images and languages. My problem as a writer, using words, is to dispel the illusions of language while employing one of the languages that generates them. I can succeed only on the principle of a hair of the dog that bit you. Apart from such human artifacts as buildings and roads, especially Roman and American roads, our universe, including ourselves, is thoroughly wiggly. Its features are wiggly in both shape and conduct. Clouds, mountains, plants, rivers, animals, coastlines, all wiggle. They wiggle so much, and in so many different ways, that no one can really make out where one wiggle begins and another ends, whether in space or in time. Some French classicist of the 18th century complained that the creator had seriously fallen down on the job by failing to arrange the stars with any elegant symmetry, for they seemed to be sprayed through space like the droplets from a breaking wave. Is all this one thing wiggling in many different ways, or many things wiggling on their own? Are there things that wiggle, or are the wigglings the same as the things? It depends upon how you figure it. Millennia ago, some genius discovered that such wiggles as fish and rabbits could be caught in nets. Much later, some other genius thought of catching the world in a net. By itself, the world goes something